From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project.
Overlooking historic Bryant Park in Midtown Manhattan, live from NPR Studios, this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. News, information, West Virginia, Mountain Mama, Take Me Home, Country Roads. I'm Mike Pasca.
And I'm John Denver. No, I'm not. I'm Rachel Martin. It's Friday, May 9th, 2008, and we are going to talk about the upcoming primary in the great state of West Virginia. But before we do that,
you spied
something that got in your craw.
Where is the primary? May be the front page news of the Charleston Gazette and papers like that. The front page news of the New Light of Myanmar, which is the official government paper in the former Burma, where they've been hit with a terrible and devastating natural disaster, featured the Prime Minister, Thein Sein, handing over 20 television sets and 10 DVD players as part of his relief operation. He was handing them out in a region where there has been no electricity for days since the storm struck. I couldn't believe that as an example of message management.
Yeah, someone should get fired for that.
And when you get fired from the state-run newspaper, you really get fired, as in firing squad. Aside from our West Virginia chat, we'll also talk with Daniel Holloway, who's here with a roundup of weekend movies on the docket, Speed Racer, What Happens in Vegas, and a surf movie documentary.
Also, a new documentary follows China's answer to American Idol. The director of the film is here to talk about it. We'll also get the day's news headlines in just a minute, but first, tensions are high in Beirut, Lebanon, as after 3 days of gun battles, Hezbollah fighters have taken control of much of the city.
Heavy fighting in Beirut has left at least 11 dead and 20 wounded. Hezbollah fighters, who are Shiites, fought Sunni pro-government groups and have now taken over the Muslim area of the capital city. Earlier today, they attacked a pro-government TV station and forced it off the air.
Rania Masri of Raleigh, North Carolina, is a professor at Balamont University in Lebanon. She was caught in a high-rise apartment building near much of the fighting.
The shooting has been almost nonstop since 4 p.m. yesterday, almost nonstop. At most, there's 2 to 3 minutes of silence, and then there's gunfire. Personally, I'm unfamiliar with these sounds. People are hiding within their homes. They're staying away from the windows. Myself, I was on the 8th floor. I went down to the 6th floor, where it's a little bit safer. I've had friends who have spent the night in the bathtubs with their children. So people are trying to stay as much as they can into the interior of their homes.
The clashes began earlier this week when Lebanon's government declared Hezbollah's private military communications network illegal. Hezbollah's leaders say that the ruling amounted to a declaration of war against the group.
The violence marks an escalation in tensions that have been simmering in Lebanon for some time now. Many observers are drawing parallels to the civil war that gripped the country from 1975 to 1990. Yesterday in Washington, State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said the U.S. is monitoring the situation.
Certainly, as we are watching this unfold, it is a source of concern for us. I'm sure that it is even an even greater source of concern for the Lebanese people, who have once again seen their daily lives interrupted.
A National Security Council spokesman Gordon Jandro said of the violence, quote, Hezbollah needs to make a choice, be a terrorist organization or be a political party, but quit trying to be both. They need to stop their disruptive activities now.
Meanwhile, in Lebanon, Rayan Masri says people there are trying to stay optimistic in the face of the violence.
It's like there's an enforced sense of calm. That may not be realistic. What we do know is, so long as it remains in select neighborhoods in Beirut, then there is hope that it can be stopped through negotiation. So if it's going to die down, it will die down within the next few days or within the next week. If it does not die down within the week, then we are into a different stage of warfare.
You can go to NPR.org throughout the day for updates on this story. Now let's get some more of today's headlines with the BPP's Mark Garrison.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Mike. The UN has stopped aid shipments to Myanmar. They say the military government there is seizing supplies meant for cyclone victims. The Southeast Asian nation, previously known as Burma, is also under fire for refusing to let foreign aid workers in. The BBC's Paul Donahar has seen the devastation there firsthand.
We're in the Irrawaddy Delta. We've driven down to as far as you can get before you hit the flooded area. We've gone to a place called Bogle. From there, the army are taking the relief supplies that they have, loading them onto small boats and taking them into the flooded areas. What's become clear from the travelling around that we've done is that it wasn't the cyclone that took many of the lives. The thing that took the lives was a tidal surge that washed its way through the western part of the delta, because it's the communities that were living on the inlets, the streams and rivers that make up that delta. They were the ones that were washed away, and it's taken communities of 200 or 300 people at a time.
The BBC's Paul Donahar reporting from Myanmar. Here in the U.S., parts of the southeast are recovering from a string of deadly storms. Damage and injuries have been reported from Mississippi to Virginia. A tornado in North Carolina was strong enough to blow trucks off the road. This is the same weather system that tore through Oklahoma a day earlier. The Democratic presidential candidates are stumping in Oregon today. It's the only state that does its elections entirely by mail. NPR's Ina Jaffe has more from Portland.
Voters here have had their ballots for about a week. They have until May 20th to mail them back or drop them off in special boxes. Barack Obama has led in the polls here, and his campaign has been predicting that this is where he'll finally win the majority of the pledged delegates. He'll begin the day discussing the economy with high-tech workers near Portland and end it at a rally at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Hillary Clinton returns to her signature issue of health care this morning, leading a panel discussion at a Portland Children's Hospital. She began her swing through Oregon last night in the small town of Center Point after stops in West Virginia and South Dakota. Along the way, she said she was determined to stay in the race and maintained she'd be the stronger Democratic candidate in the fall.
NPR's Ina Jaffe reporting. We'll have more on the race for you in just a second. Up next, a conversation looking ahead to the vote in West Virginia. In the Senate, Louisiana Republican David Vitter is getting a break. The Ethics Committee will not investigate the senator for links to an escort service. The service was run by the so-called D.C. Madam, Deborah Jean Palfrey. Palfrey killed herself after her conviction for racketeering and money laundering. The Senate Ethics Committee said it would not investigate because Vitter wasn't charged and he didn't use his public office for improper purposes. President Bush's daughter, Jenna, gets married this weekend. The president will walk her down the aisle at the family ranch in Crawford, Texas. Jenna Bush is marrying Henry Hager. Hager's a former White House aide and son of a prominent Republican. It's a private event for about 200 guests. No media access. That is your news for now. It's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
So I promised I wouldn't play the song, but I will quote lyrics. Dark and dusty, painted on the sky, misty taste of moonshine, teardrops in my eye. That's right, folks. This never-ending primary season has taken us on a road trip around America, visiting states in the political spotlight. Today, West Virginia. Who is West Virginia? Some facts about the Mountain State. It has the highest average altitude east of the Mississippi. Its country roads, indeed, will always take you home. It is the best state ever, according to BPP producer and West Virginia native Ian Chillog. There's amazing whitewater rafting there. Oh, and I learned the hard way that no one who lives in West Virginia actually calls it West Virginia. My apologies. Just FYI, much more acceptable, I've been told, is West by God, Virginia. However you say it, this state has 39 delegates up for grabs, and its primary is Tuesday. To find out more about just who this West Virginia is, we're joined on the line now by Robert Rupp, who teaches political science at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Hi, Robert.
Hey, hello, good morning, and welcome to the Mountain State.
Well, thanks for having us. Hey, give us the answer to the big meta question, the demographic rundown. Who are West Virginians?
West Virginians are the prototype of Appalachia. In fact, I think they've now just made a subgroup of a minority group of Appalachian Americans.
And who are the Appalachians?
They're good people. They're mountaineers. They're overwhelmingly white. And in terms of education, they have a lower education profile, a lower income, and they have plenty of pride and belief in family.
So if I were to be hiking through the Appalachian Range or even on the streets of Charleston in a more urban setting, and I just stopped at random and asked people ahead of this primary what issues are most important to them, what do you think their likely responses would be?
They're going to say economy, 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 as would any poor state. Ironically, though, West Virginia is counter-cyclical. in the 1970s was a very good decade because of the energy crisis, and now this now we're in a better situation because we're a coal state in an energy crisis. But it's key is the economy, and I think what's important here is the word jobs, because in West Virginia, you're not only talking about a job for yourself, you're talking about a job that's going to keep your family, your kids in the state rather than going to North Carolina or someplace else. So,
is that a problem, Robert? Are a lot of younger generations, younger people leaving the state?
Yes, there's a very strong out-migration because we don't have the jobs for our kids. And the other thing, too, which you may not realize, we have one of the highest commuting rates of a state east of the Mississippi, and the reason is because there aren't any jobs in the area, but we want to stay with our families, so we get in the car and, you know, drive an hour and a half, because that, you know, in that county, there's a job for us.
So you care about oil prices?
Yes.
Now, you wrote an op-ed recently breaking down the West Virginia primary called Clinton, Obama, and the Four Fs. I thought this was really interesting. Explain, what are the Four Fs?
Yeah, the Four Fs, I first heard when Kennedy came here, they tried to explain the political landscape of West Virginia. And they broke it down to the Four Fs: food, flag, family, and faith. Food is basically jobs, you know, what it can do for the economy. And an interesting story is that when Kennedy was down in Logan County, no one would introduce him because he was a Catholic and they thought he might be a liability. So the announcer got up and said, "Boys," he said, "it's better to eat fish on Friday and have meat 6 days a week." Now, my students don't understand that because they weren't alive when the Catholics ate fish on Friday. Mm-hmm. But do you see the point of the introduction? Don't let the man's faith put you off, because he's going to bring you jobs, mm-hmm. food. The second F is flag. We have more American Legions and VFW posts than we do high school. A very large percentage of our youth serve in the military, so the military service is very important. And the third F is family. We're very family-oriented, and you'd be wise if you're campaigning to bring your family down here, and it's not by accident that Bill and Chelsea have been here at least four different times. And the fourth F is faith. We're libertarian, but in instinct default, but religion does play a key role and should be addressed.
So, Robert, based on those, that breakdown, food, flag, family, and faith, which of the four Fs most distinguishes or draws the most severe or distinctive line between Clinton and Obama in West Virginia?
Well, Hillary is basically, read this, op-ed before it was written. Because you have down here someone who initially would not fit in this state, right? You're having someone raised in the suburbs, went to Ivy League, millionaire, mm-hmm. And also a woman in a state that has only one woman that's been reelected to statewide office. So she kind of remade. So she constantly gives those concrete proposals, about jobs and food.
And she's kind of recrafted herself in the wake of Pennsylvania.
I think this is the story of the campaign, and it was up to Obama and Hillary who was going to reintroduce themselves, and she has done this. Right now, she has tried to become John Edwards and is doing a good job of it in the last weeks on the stump. She is one of those. In fact, there's even the Hillary campaign has put out a pro-gun, or at least attacking Obama on guns. Who would have thunk it 10 years ago that Hillary would adopt this kind of populist, "I'm one of you, one of the boys," attitude?
So, Robert, last question. Is this Hillary's state to lose?
Yes. Out of all the states, this is Clinton country. And not only that, and they've been coming here because I think they want to bump it up. They not only want to win this, they want to win this by 20-25%.
Well, we will wait till Tuesday to find out what happens in the great state of West Virginia. Robert Rupp is a professor of political science at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Hey, Robert, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Listen, take care.
You too.
West Virginia, oh, my home. West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still, in the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home. It's been years now since I lived there, and this city life's about got the best of me.
Not, in fact, the vocal stylings of Hillary Clinton. That is Hazel Dickens. And coming up, Daniel Holloway is on the line with the weekend's new movie releases. And later in the show, the new BPP Book Club selection. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still, in the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always online at npr.org. So if I said to you, hey, you know, there are some famous TV funny men from West Virginia, you might say, all right, like Soupy Sales, I knew he grew up there. And you'd say, no. The most beloved TV funny man from West Virginia is Don Knotts. See what I did there? Because he's the most beloved, you care more. Hey, deers are cool animal. Yeah, that's true. But in their particular family, the cervidae is also the elk. That is the coolest or the most cool animal of the family, cervidae. My point being that we are always obsessed with the most.
I gotta say, I feel like we're just charting your descent into madness with these intros. Just gonna lay them all out, and at the end, you're shaking on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
I am the most crazy person in the studio right now as we share the most emails.
That's a high bar.
Yeah, I know. Of all the stories throughout the internet. Dan, would you like to start off with your most?
I would love to. Thank you, Mike. Most emailed from Yahoo News. You
is
know
what? Cervidae?
I don't think so. Right. When we're all here in the morning, first thing, 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we're all looking for most and rambles and top stories. We're emailing them over to each other. We all see these headlines appear in our inboxes, one after the other. And I happen to notice that today there was an especially large concentration of truly bizarre headlines. And this headline was the one that caused me to make said declaration. Omaha man uses steak knife to perform self-tracheotomy.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah,
impressive.
I mean, that didn't happen yesterday. That's not an everyday occurrence.
Give the details.
An Omaha man struggling to breathe used a steak knife to perform an atom tracheotomy. He thought he was going to die when he awoke one night last week and couldn't breathe. He didn't call 911. He didn't think they'd get there in time. So this 55-year-old guy took a steak knife, poked a small hole in his own throat, allowing air to gush in. He suffered from throat cancer and related breathing problems for several years, and he had a similar episode a couple years ago, and he felt like this was the same thing.
So he knew time was short.
Yeah. And he's from Omaha, so a steak eater.
Exactly.
I would have gone with the paring knife. The serrated. Ugh.
When time is short, you got to make sure you're gonna get all the way through to the air hole.
Is he okay?
Yeah. Not only is he okay, but doctors don't expect him, Mr. Wilder, to suffer any adverse effects from the tracheotomy once it's healed.
And he's going into medicine.
Yeah, right.
The knife could not be reached for comment. Yeah, Ian, what's your
therapy.
Most?
This is a most from the Columbus Dispatch, a most emailed there. Okay, you know Cleveland played Washington in the NBA playoffs?
Yes,
Cleveland
won.
Cleveland triumphed. But Washington fans were saying that LeBron James was, complaining about a lot of fouls. Mm-hmm. So a D.C. area Papa John's made T-shirts calling LeBron James a crybaby. Thing is, Papa John's is a chain. They have branches in Ohio. People got very upset.
They left their left flank exposed.
Yeah. Complained. So Cleveland Papa John's, area Papa John's said, okay, we'll have 23-cent pizzas for you. you know, to make it up to you, 23 being LeBron James' number. But, you know, I was thinking you can't really buy their affections. They were mad. They loved their LeBron James. No, in fact, they flocked to Papa John's. One manager had to call police to close down the store, and he was afraid a riot was going to break out. All these people in other Papa John's waited hours for their pizza.
If it had worked the other way, and Papa John's in Cleveland insulted Gilbert Arenas,
yeah.
Now his uniform number is 0, right, so it would have been free pizza.
Now, I think I just solved the conundrum of low voter turnout in America.
Free pizza.
23-cent pizza in the polls, baby, I'm telling you.
I think that's 100%. Illegal.
Is it?
Hey, Trisha, what's up?
Trisha the Killjoy.
Yeah, really. Come on now. We're about to have the most delicious election day ever.
So sorry. And I'm actually going to change the tone here also with my story. I have one of the most viewed at Yahoo News, acting Mexican police chief killed. Thursday, the acting federal police chief of Mexico, his name was Edgar Milan Gomez, was shot 10 times after he opened the door to his apartment, and two bodyguards were wounded. He died in the hospital. He was named acting federal police chief in March, so he hasn't been on the job very long. They have one suspect under arrest, and this shooting comes after a big crackdown on drug cartels and organized crime. So, you know, they're not saying who the suspect is, but I would think the first leap you would make is that it was somebody who would be angry about what's the big crackdown. He's the second top federal police official killed in less than a week.
No.
A police intelligence analyst was killed May 2nd in an apparent armed robbery attempt. So there's a lot of outrage among the organized crime community in Mexico.
Dangerous job.
Yeah. You got another one?
You have one more?
Yes, I do. I have...
Go for it.
This was actually sent to us by our loyal listener, Dave Wiley. He turned us on to this, although I think we also found it on our own this morning. One of the most emailed stories on the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
The headline, Great Tits Cope Well with Warming. This story means a lot to me personally because I'm a big fan of birds. This is about these birds in Britain. They're called Great Tits. And, you know, as climate change alters the temperature, the food source available to these birds, these caterpillars that they eat, they're emerging earlier. They're earlier from their cocoons, and so I think there's been this concern that the great tits would not have any food to eat. So they actually, though, are turning out to be hatching 2 weeks earlier than normal. So they're eating well, and they're doing great. And there are other bird species around the world are not doing as well. So that's why people are really, really focusing on the great tits.
Yes.
And really,
so
really emailing it.
It's kind of
lot.
Like a global warming success story in
which
many
is,
ways.
Which must be why the BBC made it one of the most viewed and emailed stories.
Yeah, I think that's why, because I think people are concerned about
great
birds.
Great tits coping well with warming. Love the birds there in Britain. Rachel, what do you got?
I have one of the most emailed from the NewYorkTimes.com. It's the title of the piece. The headline is, Can You Become a Creature of New Habits? And the whole gist of the article is that scientists have revealed in a recent study that it will actually make you more creative and innovative. You will actually create entirely new brain cells if you develop new habits.
Well, to quote Johnny Dangerously, I've been thinking of taking up smoking, and this clinches it.
There you go. New reason. It will boost your creativity. The whole gist of this is that don't bother trying to kick off your old bad habits or just old habits in general. The only way you can really countermand those is to develop new, more positive habits. So,
which will erase the bad habits.
It erases the bad habits.
Yeah.
There you go.
Something, I'm thinking maybe what those habits are might play a role, but let's not say that.
All habits.
And those are your mostest stories, the stories and more on our website at npr.org/Bryant Park. And I think there's a feller named Matt Martinez here to do a little most.
Yeah, I have one more. I have one more. Yeah, thanks for totally forgetting about me, Mike. Appreciate that.
Forget, I just want to plug the website at every opportunity.
All right. Yeah. I have one of the most emailed at npr.org. It's a report about something that's always intrigued me and actually confounded me a little bit. It's about how a building becomes certified as being green. You know how people say it's a green building, but what exactly makes a building green? Well, NPR reporter Ted Robbins tried to explain the process you have to go through to get a building certified. He followed the City Center development in Las Vegas, and that center meets the building industry's green building standards, are called LEED standards. It stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. But the standards by which they judge buildings, these standards as green, are in contention. So here's Ted Robbins to sort it all out.
Standing in the midst of construction for the City Center project on the Las Vegas Strip, it's hard to imagine it's conserving anything. 76 acres of soaring and curving hotels, condos, shopping and entertainment space in the desert. But Cindy Ortega touts its sustainability. She is VP of Energy and Environmental Services for MGM Mirage, which owns City Center.
It's beautiful, isn't it? See the curvature of the steel? Now, the reason why this is environmental, you see this guy welding this steel right here? Steel is 95% recycled.
Actually, using recycled steel is common practice. Steel is the most recycled material on the planet. But City Center is even recycling construction waste, including the concrete left over when the old Boardwalk Casino was blown up to make way for the new development.
And so instead of hauling it away out to some pile out in the hills out here, we crushed it up on site and reused it for the roads here.
The goal is a green development. The proof is LEED certification. Bill Browning is a founding member of the U.S. Green Building Council, which administers LEED. He helped write the standards.
In the early 90s, we didn't have a good way of defining what was a green building and how could you measure the performance of a building in terms of energy, indoor air quality, how it dealt with the habitat and stormwater.
So the council came up with a point system. The more a builder does to make a development sustainable, the more points the development gets.
The rating has different levels, certified, silver, gold, and platinum.
But to get to platinum, you really have to push.
Less than 20, 30 buildings out of 7,000 in the system have achieved platinum at this point.
The Las Vegas City Center is going for LEED Silver. That means high-efficiency windows, lots of natural light, reclaimed water for landscaping, and an on-site electric generating plant which uses excess heat to warm the buildings. A gold rating would have required much more. Some things which make sense in the desert, some which don't. And with LEED, it's pretty much one size fits all. MGM Mirage Vice President Gordon Apsher.
I was in a meeting one time on City Center where LEED experts were arguing we should pursue rainwater catch basins. And all of these experts in from all over finally were stopped in their tracks when somebody from Las Vegas said, "Folks, it rains 3 inches a year here. Maybe we should move on and talk about something else."
Another criticism of LEED, it gives the same number of points for minor improvements, like installing bike racks, as it does for putting in a costly, energy-efficient heating and cooling system. And regardless of the point score, you have to prove a building is green. Just the process of getting LEED certification can be cumbersome. Bill Browning again.
Yeah, early on, boy, to do the documentation, you wound up with an entire bookshelf of documents. It was just horrific.
In fact, City Center has an office just to fill out LEED paperwork. For this huge complex, that might not be a problem. For a smaller developer, the added $20,000 to $30,000 could be significant. But Bill Browning says a buyer needs proof.
I come out of the real estate development industry, and I know how outrageous people claims about buildings and what I'm doing with this and that and the marketing claims and all that. But when you see that plaque on the wall and you see the point score, you know, that's someone else who's done the paperwork and said, yep, they're actually doing that.
So here's what's happening. LEED standards are being rewritten as we speak. Certification is being streamlined and moved online. Other building organizations are writing their own green building standards, and cities and counties across the country are adapting elements of LEED which fit local conditions. Building to LEED Silver Standard at Las Vegas City Center is adding about 2% to upfront construction costs. But MGM Mirage VP Gordon Apsher says energy, waste, and water savings will make that up and more in the long run.
You can make money and do the right thing at the same time.
Right now, building to LEED is voluntary. As costs come down and building codes change, it's possible building green won't be newsworthy, but standard practice.
That's NPR's Ted Robbins reporting. You can find links to that and all the stories you heard on the most at our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.
Thank you. When your name is Speed Racer, there's not a lot of options about what you're going to do with your life. You're probably going to wind up being a Speed Racer, and that is exactly what happened to the man in the movies. The weird part is that his brother, heart surgeon, he actually works in a Lowe's in Encino. It's funny. Life is funny. Daniel Holloway, now that's a pseudonym also. His given name was Guy Movie Watcher, and then he changed it to Daniel Holloway in an attempt to skirt destiny. But you know what? You can't avoid fate. And your fate, Mr. Guy Movie Watcher, is to join us today on the BPP to talk about the latest films. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Mike. Yeah, I actually wanted to be a television critic, and Guy Movie Watcher wasn't going to work for that.
Right, yeah. That was too far afield.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You could have also, you know, gone the route of the your cousin, fella who gives his opinion without being asked. But we are asking you. We want to know. And did you go to Speed Racer Go?
Yeah, I did go to Speed Racer Go. And I was I had mixed feelings.
Yeah.
That way.
What were the good part of the mix?
The good part of the mix was that, you know, this is the Wachowski's first film since The Matrix. Mm-hmm. And whatever you liked about The Matrix, you're probably going to like about this movie, meaning the action sequences. Now, they're a lot different. This is a kid's movie, and they adopted this really great, really bright color palette and applied it to the same sort of things they were doing in The Matrix, except with an awesome race car. And so you get a lot of awesome action sequences. The problem is the Wachowskis have never met an awesome action sequence that they can't mess up with a lot of tedious exposition. And they do a lot of that, especially in the first hour of the movie. You know, Speed will be driving the Mach 5. And, you know, through these insane racetracks that the Wachowskis have built, computer-generated racetracks that defy all types of laws and
right.
physics. And you just want to watch him drive the car, and they can't let him drive the darn car without cutting to multiple flashbacks and people talking. And, you know, and they write their films, too, and they just shouldn't. They should not be allowed near a computer that has any type of word processing program on it.
Whoa, dang.
Well, if you think following the Speed Racer learning to drive on film is tough, we're going to play a little of that on radio. Here, let's listen.
Feel that shimmy? It's your hind legs trying to outrun your front.
What do I do?
Stop steering and start driving. This ain't no dead piece of metal. The car's a living, breathing thing, and she's alive. You can feel her talking to you, telling you what she wants, what she needs. All you gotta do is listen. Close your eyes and listen.
And that clip is typical of the level of dialogue and also the fact that every scene is underscored by pretty intense music. What do you think of the adjectives assaultive, bombastic, at times painful to describe this movie?
I think that would probably work. You know, those words are words that I would definitely use to describe the last two Matrix films, and particularly that clip that you played there reminded me of the thing that annoyed me most about those films, which was just how self-important the movies are.
I know.
This movie, it's certainly not as self-important, but you certainly get that, you know, that Speed's, this sense of destiny around Speed is being pounded into your head, bludgeoned into your head over and over again.
Well, I guess they know that their lead character has attention deficit disorder. They show him in a class. I saw it on an IMAX, and they show him in a classroom, and he can't fill out a test, and he fidgets, and he needs to race. So their lead character has attention deficit disorder. They're trying to instill in their audience attention deficit disorder, and I guess they feel that it worked because they got to say the same thing 14 times or else people won't pay attention.
You know, and maybe that's not a bad strategy. Maybe there's a lot of people watching
work,
out there with ADD, and, you know, this is the perfect thing. But I really think you got to give the audience a little bit more credit than that.
Most of the reviews have been terrible, but some people do say things like, you know, I could see in 20 years this thing having a cult-like status.
It's really cool to look at.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it could. It's not. The thing is, though, it's, there's definitely some Blade Runner qualities to it visually, but it's not smart the way the Blade Runner is, and there's no one doing anything that, you know, that is done in that movie on an intellectual level.
Let's move to What Happens in Vegas, a movie based on a tagline from a Chamber of Commerce. I think that might say it all. Give us a little idea of the plot of this movie, Daniel.
The plot is that Ashton Kutcher loses his job. Cameron Diaz gets dumped by her boyfriend. They both head separately to Vegas, get drunk, wind up married. He uses her quarter to win $3 million in a slot machine. She tries to take half the money. They go to court, and Dennis Miller tells them to stay married for 6 months before he'll give either of them half the money, and then they start being mean to each other.
There is really no point to watch the movie now. Was succinct.
There was no point for me to watch it. I wish I just read the description on the internet and pretended to have seen it, but I unfortunately did see it.
Let's hear a little clip of Jack and Joy, the two characters played by Ashton and Cameron, meeting for a drink.
So, Joy,
yeah?
What brings you to Sin City?
You know, just being spontaneous, cutting loose like everyone else. How about yourself?
Yeah, me? I just got fired. So, cheers to that.
So, Daniel, did you think this is the kind of movie where you saw every twist and turn coming from a mile away?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's the, and they're, yeah, if you can call them twists and turns, I mean, you basically see that it's more like looking up a staircase that drops off into hell.
Or with a big bowling ball descending the staircase. One thing this movie does do is the age difference between Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz. It usually works the other way, where the male is older than the woman. And
She's only like a couple years older.
Yeah, but well, in real life, he dates or is married. Not dates Demi Moore.
Yeah,
they're married.
She's 6 years older than him.
Six. And, okay.
To be honest, like it's not. They're both still disgustingly attractive people.
Right.
You know, it's not really that distracting. And considering, you know, the number of times that you see, like, I don't know, Abe Vigoda cast opposite Scarlett Johansson, then...
Yeah. I'd watch that movie, by the way. I did a little searching. Patrick Dempsey was 10 years older than Reese Witherspoon in Sweet Home Alabama. Mm-hmm. Kate Hudson, 15 years younger than Matt Dillon in You, Me, and Dupree. Harrison Ford, 27 years younger than Anne Heche in 6 Days, 7 Nights. And no one talks about this, but Lord of the Rings. Viggo Mortensen, 27 years older than Liv Tyler.
Jeez.
Yeah.
27 years old.
Well, he's I think he's 50, Viggo Mortensen.
Man.
Yeah. Very quickly. You like the documentary Surfwise? Very quickly.
Fantastic movie. It's about a guy named Dorian Doc Paskowitz who raised his family as surfing nomads. He had a wife and 9 kids. They spent more than 2 decades in a 24-foot RV, traveling the U.S., surfing, eating gruel, running around half naked. And this film consists of interviews with the now grown children and the aged parents, and also some, they were stars of the surfing scene, so they attracted a lot of television crews at the time.
Daniel Holloway, who writes reviews for Metro newspapers. Happy vacation, Daniel.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Come back soon.
Will do.
Next up on the BPP, China's answer to American Idol. Film about that. We're going to talk with the documentary maker. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. You know, we are in so many places, you can't escape us, really. We're on digital, FM, Sirius Satellite Radio, and online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Mike Pesca. Coming up, Supergirl Singing Contest, a documentary about a Chinese Supergirl Singing Contest. But first, let's get the latest news headlines from the BPP's Mark Garrison.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Mike. At first, it looked like Iraqi forces made a big catch overnight, al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq. But now word from the U.S., the prisoner is someone else. NPR's Ivan Watson is in Baghdad with more.
At midnight on Thursday, Iraqi officials announced on state TV the capture of Abu Ayyub al-Masri, the Egyptian-born leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. But U.S. military authorities say the man who was captured last night is not, in fact, al-Masri. They say the suspect is another al-Qaeda in Iraq militant who uses the same code name. Iraqi security forces have broadcast false alarms in the past, claiming to have killed al-Masri. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has been on the defensive for the past year, fighting a war on several fronts against U.S. and Iraqi security forces, as well as against Sunni Arab tribal militias.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. A disease that's killing Chinese children keeps getting worse. At least 25,000 nationwide have hand, foot, and mouth disease. There are fears of a wider epidemic. Now the U.S. is offering to help. We'll have a conversation about China in just a moment. Fears of a new civil war in Lebanon as street violence there escalates into its third day. Kate Seeley has the story from Beirut.
Violent clashes are continuing between anti-government fighters loyal to Hezbollah and supporters of Lebanon's pro-Western government. Hezbollah and its allies have the upper hand, however. Their fighters have deployed throughout West Beirut in neighborhoods largely loyal to the government. Hezbollah claims its attacks are justified. Yesterday, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah accused officials of declaring war on his group. That after a government decision on Tuesday to declare the militia's communication network illegal. The Arab world and international community have appealed for calm as Lebanon teeters on the brink of a new civil war.
That's Kate Seeley reporting from Beirut. Facebook is beefing up security. They put in new safeguards after working with state attorneys general from around the nation. Facebook will ban convicted sex offenders from the 70 million member social networking site. It will also limit older users' ability to contact underaged members. Facebook says some of the changes are already in place. The attorneys general made a similar deal with MySpace earlier this year. Don't forget, Mother's Day is Sunday. A new survey estimates the value of mom's work at $117,000 a year. Salary.com got the numbers by looking at pay levels for 10 jobs that overlap with what mothers do. They include everything from CEO to housekeeper to psychologist to teacher. The number, of course, includes lots of overtime. Get ready for that, Allison Stewart, and have a happy Mother's Day, everybody. That is your news for now. It's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
Think back to the last film that you saw by a Chinese filmmaker with a Chinese cast depicting some aspect of Chinese life. If one came to mind, maybe it was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or House of Flying Daggers, maybe Farewell My Concubine. One thing all those films have in common, along with most Chinese films we get here in the States, is that they don't really show us anything about modern life in the People's Republic of China. Those realities are often left to China's independent filmmakers. A scene not just underground in mainland China, but technically illegal. That's because some of what's depicted in these films doesn't quite jibe with the Communist Party line. But some independent films are starting to make it into American markets, offering for the first time a candid look behind China's bamboo curtain. Jian Yi is an independent filmmaker based in Beijing. He's the director of the new feature documentary called Supergirls, currently screening around the country. And he joins us here in the studio along with Karen Chien. She's the president of Degenerate Films, a New York-based distributor of independent Chinese films. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you. It's our pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start with you, Jian Yi. Your film Supergirls follows some 80,000 young girls who are dreaming of being on this show, Supergirl Singing Contest. So naturally, in America, we think, oh, this is like Chinese American Idol. Is that essentially what it's like?
The Supergirl Singing Contest was modeled on the Pop Idol in the UK and American Idol in the US. So it started in 2004 at a TV program in the province. And it was very successful. So they made it a national program on 2005. And in 2005, it was so successful that 400 million people watch it.
400 million people?
Wow. Yeah, in that year.
Huh.
And then the champion of that year appeared on the cover of the Time magazine and became one of the 10 or 20 Asian heroes of that year.
Let's kind of set the scene a little bit. Let's play a clip of some of the girls warming up for their audition performances. And the songs, they sing everything. They sing everything from Chinese pop to American pop hits, even rap. Let's take a listen.
Have you gotten over? Have you started a brand new life? Have you met somebody, someone who's starting Arizona unlike me?
为什么他竟然爱上他知道底在想什么他是否知道帅哥不能爱是什么让他忘了放弃不知道该做什么我说的怎么可能我们都需要勇气去相信会在一起让超拥挤我能感觉你放在 We just heard a lot of different kinds of music. I mean, we heard people singing in English. We heard some rapping. It's a wide range. It was such a popular show that so many people voted and participated in this that there was a lot of writing that happened that said, oh, this is the most democracy that China has seen ever.
Well, it is one of the most important cultural phenomena in the recent years. It's a TV program that has a democratic aspect to it. In part of my show, I filmed how the girls were rallying votes for their heroes on the street. You know, this is something that when I was filming it, I was very, very surprised. I'm impressed because, you know, never before in my life had I seen anyone rallying any votes on the street. know, in a very spontaneous
campaigning,
way.
Campaigning, essentially.
Yeah, like campaigning. I've never seen that before.
Why did you decide that this would make a good idea for a film to follow these, you say, 10 or so people who are taking part in this? What triggered your imagination?
I think even in the independent filmmaking world, people tend to make films more about the marginalized people and underprivileged people, which I think is very important, you know, to represent their voices. But the thing is that, you know, then on the other hand, the mainstream culture in China is somehow underrepresented because, you know, you either see the mainstream Chinese culture from the government channel or you don't see much from an independent perspective. This show was on in 2005, was very popular, and it started in June, and many of my friends were watching it, and I thought, you know, at the beginning I thought it was too vulgar to watch it, you know, just, you know, terribly
Why?
Superficial. I thought it seemed to me very girlish, very, you know, it's only for girls, it's not like the American Idol, it's for both gender. And then I watched one of the shows in July, and my butt was glued to the couch for the rest of the season.
So Why? What was so compelling about it that time?
Because I've never seen such spontaneous things before. And I've never seen such participation in a TV show before.
Huh.
So, you know, I also, you know, I've never voted in my life for anyone. But I, you know, in that year, I started voting for the girl I liked, the thing I liked.
Describe that feeling.
You feel you can make a difference. You know, you feel like never before that you can make a difference, you know, in somebody else's life, and you know your vote counts. That's how you felt. You know, I don't know what
how
is really behind
is, yeah.
the scene, but that's how you felt.
Well, let's talk about how this show can potentially change someone's life. You mentioned the winner in 2005 was on the cover of Time magazine and was made a national star. What are the motivations that these girls have? The best case scenario would be what? They would be a major Chinese pop star, or do they get a record deal?
The thing is that once you win, once you become one of the top 10 of the national final, you have to sign a contract with a TV station. It's compulsory. I don't remember, it's 10 years or 20 years. So for
that
the next
seriously
10 or
changes your
yeah,
life.
Yeah, for the next 10 or 20 years, you are on a contract with this TV station.
What has been the reception? You've been touring around the States and screening the film at different universities. How have people reacted to it?
I think most of them were very surprised to see China in that kind of perspective. You know, many of them commented saying that, you know, this is not very different than America or than the American Idol.
I want to bring Karen into the conversation to talk a little more about some of the obstacles involved in independent filmmaking in China. In the intro to this segment, we referenced the fact that doing this, independent filmmaking, is technically illegal. Can you explain that?
The filmmaking industry in China is governed in a large part by the state, as are other businesses in China. And in order to get a film made, the script has to go through the censorship board and the approval, as well as the final film. You know, you need permits from the government, so on and so forth. So the act of making a film has to be approved each step of the way by the government. So when you are making a film about content that the government might find unpleasant or disagreeable in some way, you're not going to necessarily get that approval.
So, Jian, how have you dealt with that? I mean, have you felt like people have been monitoring your work? Since you're operating under the radar, so to speak.
No. I think the government thinks that people don't watch documentaries anyway.
Oh, they think they're irrelevant.
So, yeah. So, you know, they think people don't watch documentaries anyway. So they don't monitor it as much.
I mean, in essence, filmmaking, independent filmmaking in China is, quote unquote, underground. There's a whole system of production, distribution, exhibition that is under the radar, I would say. For example, the way that a lot of documentaries are made, it really is literally just one person. I mean, here in the States, it might be five people, but you're just talking about the filmmaker, and that's it. So if you have a filmmaker running around with a mini DV camera, you know, it's pretty much under the radar. The films, I would say, don't have a huge chance to get outside the country other than through programmers, festival programmers that are looking for content, actively looking for content in China, or sometimes visiting scholars. And also through cultural institutions. I think that Europe and other parts of the world are much farther ahead than the U.S. is in terms of sourcing content from China or showing interest in independent films from China. So I think that
Why is that?
I think that's a good question. I actually went to China and started asking people that too. And I said, why are there no Americans here looking for your films? Because it's very fascinating what's happening in independent film in China right now. It's very new. There's very little infrastructure. The cinema that's happening is very risk-taking. The content's very interesting. There's a huge amount of interest in China, in the U.S., but there's maybe just a mental obstacle into getting into China. And I spoke to a number of American distributors and asked them if they're looking at Chinese content. And their answer was usually, no, we already are sourcing content from Hong Kong and Japan and Korea, which of course does not speak to the kind of content that's coming out of mainland China.
What are the films that we're getting as American film consumers? And what is that telling us about China?
We get maybe the one independent filmmaker whose films comes to the U.S., by the name of Jia Zhangke, and his films, you know, they win prizes at Venice, and, you know, he has a film at Cannes this year, so he's probably the most internationally recognized independent filmmaker in China right now. On top of his maybe one film every 2 years that we get, we also see, you know, films that really are martial arts spectacles, epics, historical epics. You know, I kind of feel like we know much more about China in the last few centuries than we do about China in the last few decades.
Are they reinforcing or debunking stereotypes that Americans have about China?
Those films are definitely not spreading information about what China is like, I would say, on a diverse level. You know, when you watch a martial arts film, what does Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon really tell you about China? Especially modern day China. Absolutely nothing about modern day China.
I want to thank both of you for coming in. We really appreciate it. Jian Yi is an independent filmmaker based in Beijing. He's the director of the new feature documentary Supergirls. And Karen Chien is the president of Degenerate Films, a New York-based distributor of independent Chinese films. Thanks to you both for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time to announce the next BPP Book Club selection. So we started a couple of months ago with the book club, and we inaugurated with a read by Hisham Matar. It was called In the Country of Men. Then we read Aaron Kyle's The God of Animals. They were both debut novels, both coming-of-age stories, both, frankly, a little sad.
Titles are similar linguistically.
There you go. They have that in common. Now we're going to change things up a little bit. Book club moderator Sarah Goodyear is here to announce the new pick. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, drum roll.
Yes.
The new book is what?
The new book is Neil Gaiman's Anansi Boys.
All right.
Yes, and it's...
Never
heard of it. Well, there are those who think that Neil Gaiman just... is the most fabulous person in the world. He has written a lot of graphic novels, a lot of comics. Uh-huh. Sandman is one of his most famous things. This is, I think, his second adult novel after American Gods. And it's just completely different from what we've been doing. And that's what I wanted to do. And I had been wanting to read him for a long time. And that's one of the reasons, selfishly,
totally,
that I picked this book. And
yes, but we should say selflessly, we all come up with a bunch of them, and you read a lot of books that we don't pick.
That's
so
true.
So you put your reading time on the line. But could you explain the title? What is an Anansi boy?
Well, Anansi is a figure from mythology or legend. He is a trickster spider, and he's sort of like the coyote in that he plays tricks, and there's stories, the tar baby story, the Brer Rabbit baby story, that is also told with Anansi. And the book is not so much about Anansi as it is about Anansi's son, Fat Charlie Nancy, who is a sad sack guy who lives in London and has a bunch of adventures that suddenly he's taken into this supernatural realm. And I'll read you a little bit from the book to let you know a little bit about Fat Charlie.
Good.
It is possibly worth mentioning that in Fat Charlie's world, women did not simply turn up. You needed to be introduced to them. You needed to pluck up the courage to talk to them. You needed to find a subject to talk about when you did. And then, once you had achieved those heights, there were further peaks to scale. You needed to dare to ask them if they were doing anything on Saturday night. And then, when you did, Mostly they had hair that needed washing that night, or diaries to update, or cockatiels to groom, or they simply needed to wait by the phone for some other man not to call. So Fat Charlie is kind of a sad sack, but he finds his long-lost brother, Spider, who turns out to be a god, and together they set out on some amazing adventures that
Don't give too much away.
That changed the world and Fat Charlie's life. Anyway, it's great stuff, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun reading it.
Cool. Very much looking forward to that. Thanks to our book club leader, Sarah Goodyear. As always, thanks for coming in. So that's our book club book, folks. Neil Gaiman's Anansi Boys. You have until Wednesday, June 4th, to read it.
Hard deadline.
That's right, folks. Go to the library. Go buy on Amazon. Find it wherever you need
to. It's in paperback, which is one of our requirements.
In the meantime, keep checking in on our blog for updates about the book. Sarah moderates a conversation there. Always compelling stuff. That's npr.org/Bryant Park. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Butterfly in the sky. I can fly twice as high. Take a look. It's in a book. Reading rainbow.
Well, that's it for this hour of the Bryant Park Project. We are online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Mike Pesca.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Happy Friday. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Read a book.